Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Here's a question for you. Are renewable energy sources hurting the environment? We'll talk about what's being done to make sure landscape is considered when new ways of producing energy are introduced. In the studio with me today from the College of Agricultural and Life Sciences, Chris Kucharik, professor and chair of the Department of Agronomy. Chris, good to have you back.
Great to be back. Thank you.
Claudio Gratton, our other guest today, professor of entomology in the College of Ag and Life Sciences. And Claudio, good to see you again.
Good to see you, Larry.
So we'll talk with them about their work with the Wisconsin Energy Institute, take your questions and comments about alternative energy and its effect on our landscape. And I hope you'll join in. What questions you have about new energies and the impact on our environment, I hope you'll join us at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. And here we have two fields of study. We've got entomology and we've got agronomy. We don't usually connect them when we think about energy production. I don't think anyway. So maybe talk first about how your work connects with the Wisconsin Energy Institute, for example. And Chris, maybe start with you.
Yeah, well, I think first and foremost, I can speak for both Claudio and I that the connection is really related to this grand challenge on planet Earth right now in solving how are we going to produce more food, more energy, and more water and have water in a sustainable way. And we call this sort of the food, energy, water nexus. How are we going to meet the demands for each more of those things and study those in an integrated fashion? You know, probably decades ago, people would study these particular questions in their own silos, but the funding agencies and really to solve the questions that we need to solve for tomorrow need to be studied in unison.
Yeah.
And so agronomy fits right in there, and as well as a lot of other disciplines, because that's a pretty broad spectrum we're talking about. And I'll let Claudio pipe in a little bit about where he comes in on that.
Yeah, cool. Exactly. I mean, for me, as an entomologist, I think about our landscapes supporting insects that we care about out there, things like pollinators, things like lady beetles that feed on pest insects. And so in the work that that we've done and the work that we've done collaboratively with Chris and with others, we really think about the management of our landscapes as affecting the wildlife that's out there, the things that provide goods and services and value for us. So it all comes together in a landscape, how we manage it, how we shape it, how we think about it. And that has consequences for people.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. So and so the Wisconsin Energy Institute sort of brings you together as part of this.
Yeah, we in particular, there's there's a lot of very smart people in
yes.
in that building. In particular, on one floor, Claudio, myself, Randy Jackson, Rob Annick, some other faculty members are part of, I guess we call the sustainability hub or area of research related to the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center, which was this, you know, very large $250 million grant first awarded in 2008 to UW as the home base for that. And, I mean, we're charged with basically trying to figure out is if we think about landscapes in the future and deriving bioenergy from that or energy sources, renewable fuels from that, we've got, like, one opportunity to get this decision right in painting the landscape differently. And we've got to understand how the changes on the landscape impact how much food we're producing, how much biofuel we can produce, how much water quality might be affected, how much carbon might be sequestered into soils. And so we're taking this very large approach, as well as the pollinators and the biodiversity and things that fall under Claudio's wing and what he studies.
Yeah. Claudio, maybe expand on that.
Yeah, actually, so I don't know if it's worth just kind of rewinding the clock back to 2007. This was kind of the beginning of the financial crisis in 2007, 2008. During the George Bush administration, the Energy Independence and Security Act was passed at the end of 2017. And the idea there was to try to make our sources of energy more locally produced, giving us less dependence on foreign sources of oil, potentially also decreasing the carbon footprint that those sources were producing. So leaning more towards bioenergy as a potential source of energy. And so the administration at the time really made a huge investment in research and in enabling these new bioenergy type technologies. And so at the time, really the only viable source of that bioenergy was in the form of ethanol coming from corn. And so what we saw in a very short period of time, 2007, 2008, is the price of corn went increased, almost doubled. And farmers started taking land that used to be considered marginal, maybe was fallow, maybe was in conservation programs for wildlife or for soil conservation, and moving it back into corn because there was this great demand for liquid ethanol to put into our gas tanks. That was mandated by this particular act. And so what we saw in a very short period of time, about 5 years after that, was a decrease of about 25% of land that used to be in conservation set-asides transitioning back into corn. So when I look at something like that, I think not just about our ability to produce energy, but I think about questions of what's that going to do for wildlife? What is that going to do for pollinators? What is that going to do for water? What is that going to do for soil? And so on. And so our team in the sustainability group was really tasked with trying to understand, trying to measure, trying to understand what those broad-ranging consequences are. So I think one of the important things of taking this landscape approach is that it forces us not just to think about one particular thing that we might want from our agricultural system, be it energy or be it a commodity or something like that, but it's to think about it in this much more diverse, pluralistic way that Chris was talking about. You know, ultimately, we have to maintain these ecosystems in a way that allows them to keep producing for future generations as well. Are we creating an agricultural system, an energy system that is going to allow us to do that into the future?
So give us some examples of this negative impact energy systems can have on our landscape, and perhaps another example.
Yeah. Well, maybe building upon the corn ethanol. Yeah. And I mean, we've been writing, doing research, publishing about this for 10 years. I mean, back to 2008, I think, was the first paper that I had helped publish on the impacts of corn ethanol on water quality. And I guess the statistic that maybe not a lot of people understand is, depending on who you talk to, 30 to 40% of the annual corn crop goes to making ethanol going into our gas tanks. As more of this land was coming out of, you know, areas where it was conserved or maybe it wasn't soybeans or something else. Corn is a very needy crop when it comes to nitrogen fertilizer. So it's not hard to understand as you start expanding the amount of corn that's being grown, you start adding more and more nitrogen fertilizer to the landscape that leaches through to our groundwater systems. Here in Wisconsin, we obviously have a significant proportion of private wells that are above the 10 parts per million of nitrate. That's the EPA safe level for drinking water. And then, you know, I'll just pick on this watershed. You know, things we do here in the Midwest eventually make their way into the Mississippi River, down to the Gulf of Mexico, and unfortunately contribute to what's referred to as the dead zone or hypoxic zone. So this is the kind of thing we want to, you know, improve upon, you know, moving forward and thinking about how do we paint the landscape differently. And water quality is just one of those things that we've touched upon. And corn ethanol has been picked on too because its energy return is only slightly better than the amount of energy that's required to actually make the fuel in the first place. We want to be pushing to cellulosic fuels, you know, fuels where we can take plant matter and that, turn it into fuels and have those types of systems have a smaller footprint on the landscape and do less environmental damage.
And in probably on those lands where we're putting corn now where we shouldn't be.
Yes, that's true. Yeah. Unfortunately, you know, a lot of conservation reserve program land was put in. That program was initiated in 1985, more of an erosion control program. And you know, it's maybe helped build soil organic matter a little bit over those 30 years or 20 years, and farmers then can go back and plant corn on there and get a significant, you know, crop for several years. And we've seen a lot more continuous corn also on the landscape.
Yeah.
Yeah, another thing that happens as we kind of transition our agricultural systems into fewer and fewer crops is that we've removed that diversity in the landscape that is really essential to supporting the kind of wildlife that we want out there. Just as a case in point, if we look at some of the bee species that we've worked on, you may have heard about the rusty patch bumblebee. Yeah. Used to be a widespread species in the Midwest all the way through to the Atlantic coast. And now, as of 2 years ago, was listed as a federally endangered species. We don't really know the reasons for that decline specifically, but for many bees, it's really been a decline in the food that's out there for them in our landscapes. So simplifying our landscapes, reducing the weeds that are out there, the natural plant communities that are out there, things that provide food and nectar for them, is one of those things that puts pressure on these populations. So we see these ramifying consequences for, as Chris said, for water, for wildlife, and they have effects that go beyond the boundaries of the individual fields that are being managed, which is also another important thing to think about.
Talking today with Claudio Graton from the Department of Entomology at UW-Madison and Chris Kacharik, who is in the and chairs, actually, the Department of Agronomy at UW-Madison, visiting with them today about incorporating energy systems into our landscape. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. Or if you want to email us, you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. And let's take a call. Mike in Milwaukee, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hello.
Hi. What's on your mind, Mike?
Well, I'm a supporter of renewable energy and have been for 40 years. But when I learned about this large solar plant that's being proposed in western Wisconsin of something to the tune of 300 megawatts, which is hard to fathom, my first question was going to be, how many acres of farmland or how many acres of land are we going to be covering up with silicon solar panels? And the question that I have is, you know, we really don't have a choice. If it's green electrons or food, how do we make a decision? And those power plants are going to be built on concrete foundations. And, you know, farmland is very, very valuable, and even more so when we have a lot of flooding causing our loss of crops in the bread belt. So I guess I'd like to ask your guests what they think of the trade-offs between solar power and food.
Yeah, that's good questions. Claudia, you want to start?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Mike, for your question. I think one of the themes that is going to emerge, whether it's bioenergy, whether it's solar, whether it's wind, is that inevitably there will be trade-offs. And what we have to ask ourselves is, how do we manage these trade-offs? Are we aware that these trade-offs exist? And Mike really brought up a good one, which is, if you're going to put something on the ground, you're excluding something else that could be there. So we're not producing potentially food or feed or even, you know, ethanol in that case, mm-hmm. in lieu of producing that energy from solar panels. So for that specific installation, the numbers that I think I've seen is that on the ground, this will be about a 2,000-acre installation. This is called the Badger Hollow plant. I think this is what Mike is referring to. They have a larger footprint that they've reserved, but I think of actual solar panels, this will be approximately 2,000 acres. Some of the things that I've seen associated with that plan have tried to mitigate the potential effects of losing that land in terms of the vegetation and what else could be there. So we have seen, and you've probably seen some of these solar installations driving down the highway that are all grass underneath the solar panels, or potentially gravel or concrete. And those are often done for weed control primarily. This particular one at Badger Hollow, the vegetation plans that I've seen associated with it is that they would actually plant a kind of a high diversity native plant mix underneath the panels themselves, with the idea that this would help with water infiltration. This could actually provide habitat for pollinators and so on. So the devil's in the details and how you do these things. If the management of whether it's bioenergy or solar energy or wind energy is done correctly, I think you can get these potential positives. both for the environment and for energy production.
Yeah. Makes good sense. It really is a great point. That's kind of what you guys are about in a lot of ways, isn't it?
Yeah. Exactly. And I think, again, Mike's point is that we have to be thinking about these trade-offs. If we're just thinking about energy, you do the math one way. But if you think about the environment, if you think about the local communities and what they would actually be benefiting or how they would be benefiting from these particular ways in which we manage our landscapes, maybe the calculus comes out a little bit differently. But if we're explicit about what those costs and benefits are, then I think we'll come up with much better and more sustainable long-term solutions that everybody's going to be happy with.
Yeah. Claudio Gratton from the Department of Entomology, Chris Kucharik from the Department of Agronomy at the UW-Madison, our guests today. Join in with your questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@WPR.org. Dave Poltratz, our engineer, Jill Nadeau, our producer, and you are listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at what's going on in the Wisconsin Energy Institute, in part, as we look at incorporating energy systems into our landscape, our guests today, Claudio Gratton, professor of entomology, Chris Kucharik, professor and chair of agronomy, both in the College of Ag and Life Sciences at UW-Madison. So great to have them with us. Certainly, if you have a question, I hope you'll join in. The number is 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@WPR.org. I think we were having some problems with our phones earlier. They seem to be resolved right now. Alan, in Sarasota, Florida, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Good morning, Larry. Good morning, guests. I am on vacation in Sarasota, but I'm a farmer at Dodgeville, and I'm one of the interveners involved in the Badger Hollow solar farm. And I just want to there's so many points of interest or consideration that should be brought up, but we've talked about the landscape, the visual landscape. The bottom line is for me is that the first filter is that do we want to have a industrial-sized solar farm that requires heavy power lines to distribute the energy and all of the money that's expended to do both? Or do we want to have the power generation where the power is going to be utilized, where we don't need the big power lines? We don't need to take precious egg soil and put it in the hands of the consumer so that you don't have to give these horrific amounts of money to the utilities so they can make money on their borrowed money to put steel in the ground so that that money can be saved just because the individual consumer can have that equity and build that equity in their own solar generation plant at within their own communities. And you don't have these industrial-sized facilities disrupting the view and the economic considerations that these will impact on a community.
Well, Alan, I thank you very much for calling. I really appreciate it. And let's turn to Chris first for a comment, or maybe Claudio. Why don't we start with you, Claudio?
Yeah. So, Alan, thank you so much for your comments. I think there are a couple things that that Alan talks about. The differences between kind of individual community scale operations versus industrial kind of corporate style, I don't really know if I can say much to that. But I do want to speak a little bit to another point that I think Alan makes, and that is that in addition to these, easy to quantify characteristics that our landscape produces for us, food, fiber, energy – There's also a lot of really important but maybe intangible aspects that people really value in our landscapes that have more to do with the aesthetic, with the spiritual. Landscapes, by definition, have a history in them. This is where we grew up. This is where our ancestors are from. They give us a sense of belonging, and as such, they have a deep meaning to us. And ignoring those components, I think, comes at our peril. We live in these communities, and it's very difficult to see our rural landscapes, having benefits for people outside of the community. So, making sure that there's kind of an equitable valuation of how we use these communities where they may have the greatest impact, I think is going to be really important. So I don't think we can really ignore, aspects like that.
Exactly. Yeah. And Chris, a comment?
Oh, they're just great, great perspectives. It's thanks, Alan, for calling in, given, you're right in Dodgeville and right in the middle of all this and presenting points of view that a lot of people may not be that familiar with. But they're difficult decisions, and I think one thing we struggle with as scientists when we start weighing the trade-offs and the pros and the cons is trying to come up with, one single number that policy decision makers can latch onto, because that's really what they want to hear. Well, which is the best here to do? And there is no easy answer. Absolutely not.
Thank you again for calling, Alan. Appreciate it. I want to give some others a chance to join in. David in East Troy will turn to you next. Hi, David.
Hello.
What can we do for you today?
My comment is, with trying to find different sources of energy, we have a good one in nuclear. I know a lot of people are afraid of it, but if you understand the risk compared to conventional methods of coal, their casualties are so much lower. There's no comparison. And there is a safer type of nuclear reactor available too. It's a higher cost method. It's called solar salt reactor.
Mm-hmm.
And now this would be, if people aren't, don't feel safe with a conventional nuclear, like Point Beach Nuclear Plant, which has been operating very efficiently all these years. It doesn't take up so much land. We need the energy, and it's a great alternative, and it's something that should be utilized more.
Let's turn to Claudio for that.
Yeah, thanks, David, for that perspective. Yeah, in terms of just energy generation, when we think about the consequences of using fossil-based fuels and their effects on the climate, on our climate systems, the alternatives that we're exploring really are trying to minimize the carbon input for the greatest energy return. And I think nuclear is something that that people have looked at, and certainly other countries have looked at it a lot more than here in the U.S. I really can't speak to the specifics that David was referring to, but in terms of, again, thinking about these trade-offs and thinking about the potential risks, right now, so far, we've been talking about things that we may be able to visualize right away, like our previous caller had asked about, Alan had asked about what happens when we take land out of agricultural production, or what happens when we have this visual, thing that we're not used to seeing in our landscape. We can see that effect right away. Something we have to think about in our energy production systems is what are the long-term consequences of their use? And maybe with nuclear energy, the short-term benefits can be felt, but there's also a risk that we have that we've seen in places like Chernobyl or like in Fukushima, where we have the risk of changing these landscapes and making them unusable for decades or perhaps even centuries to come. And so who bears the cost of doing those kinds of, having those kinds of energy operations? So not only are we trying to kind of create energy systems that are benefiting us here in the today, but we also have to think about the consequences for future generations. And I think that's where people get a little nervous about nuclear energy.
Thanks again, David. Dave in Livingston, it's your turn next. Hi, Dave. Appreciate your call.
All three of you. was wondering, what about putting windmills in the Dakotas, Nebraska, Kansas, and the prairie states? You know, I'll take my answer up there. Thanks.
All right. So looking at wind.
Yeah, I think, you know, there's definitely, you know, areas to our west. I mean, the sighting of those, from my understanding, is, you know, we're looking at, you know, what average wind speeds are, where you're going to generate, you know, get your biggest bang for your buck and sighting those. I don't know the logistics in terms of connecting wind in a different state, bringing that, you know, locally. I'm not quite sure how that works. It's a little outside my area of expertise. But, you know, definitely, you know, there, you can drive through, you know, Iowa. There's some really huge, you know, wind farms through western Iowa, eastern Nebraska. There's a few in Wisconsin that aren't that actually far outside of Madison. There's one east of here, just east of Beaver Dam in the Horicon Iron Ridge area. That's a small one. But so it's just all a matter of sighting and, like I said, getting your biggest bang for your buck on what you put out there.
And then the issue with that is transmission lines. Yeah. There are, you know, issues and controversies associated with having transmission lines. A statistic that I recently saw, Chris, is that Iowa currently generates about 30% of their electricity from wind power. So
it's amazing. Yeah.
And here's Catherine in Richland County next. Catherine, hi.
Good morning. I wanted to tag on to the farmer who called, who's from Dodgeville, about industrial versus local. I'm curious to know, in all this research, what has been discovered about what could be done locally, meaning a small community solar farm, or what could be done individually? And are there any programs, is there any research that is going that way as opposed to industrial? What I heard one of your researchers say is that people want one number, or people who are policymakers want one number. And I have to say, as a farmer, when you look at your land, you can't do one number. Each farm has to make different decisions according to how the land is, what the resources are, and what the market is. So where is that in terms of solar energy?
Yeah. Catherine, that was well stated. Thank you. And let's go to Chris for that.
Yeah. I mean, I can back up and state a little bit of how we look at things at a smaller scale before getting into the solar sort of question and sort of the ecosystem services and maybe expanding upon what I had said about this one number that policymakers sort of, you know, want to hear. And that's sort of looking at like an entire, let's say, watershed, and that watershed might be a small one or a large one, like the Ahara that, you know, a lot of us live here in the Madison area in, which is about 1,000 square kilometers. It's looking at the mosaic of, you know, different land use on the landscape and trying to come up with how do you maximize the ecosystem services, you know, by having people make different decisions. It might mean that farmer A might have to do this and farmer B might have to do something different. But all those local types of things are being taken into account when we do our type of modeling and research on the landscape scale. I would think that a similar approach probably could be taken, you know, for solar. Again, it's not something I'm that familiar with, but I guess what grabs a lot of the headlines these days is the very large, expansive projects, which immediately brings in sort of a broader, bigger issue that you bring up. I don't know, Claudia, if you had anything to add to that.
Yeah, not much more other than that local variability is really important, and we do need to take that into account. When we talk about biofuels and bioenergy, there's good places and not so good places in the landscape, and where you might want to put different kinds of crops that then can be used for bioenergy. So they need to be, that local variability really does need to be taken into account. And just another point that I think just broadens us out a little is that as we are thinking about this intersection of where we create food, where we create energy, what consequences that has for water, for wildlife, for the air, et cetera, a lot of these solutions really are best negotiated at a local scale. And so how do we create a process that actually gets us to these locally appropriate solutions that help us balance all of these things that we've been talking about in our conversation today? So, you know, Chris and I have been thinking about how do we allow users, we call them stakeholders, but really it's anybody who has an interest in what our landscapes look like. How do we create a process that allows people to talk about, to negotiate, to come up with solutions that can help balance all of these different needs in as creative a way as possible?
Mm-hmm. And I know in the many times I've talked with representatives and scientists working in the GLBRC, the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center, that there's always been the idea that there would not be one solution and that there would be many, many local solutions to the kinds of energy problems that we face.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, where in one area you may have real challenges with soils that are highly porous and, you know, we really need to think about nutrient retention, things like that. In other areas, maybe it's highly erodible soils or, you know, the ability of, you know, where can you actually site wind farms or solar panels or things like that. So I think it has to take that variability into account.
Mark in Madison emailed to ask how price supports and increased yields impacted land use in Wisconsin as related to energy production or ethanol production.
Oh, I think, you know, the sort of the larger picture that Claudio presented going back to 2007, 2008, price of corn goes from $2.50 a bushel to $7, $8 a bushel. I mean, that was a huge driver. Yeah. I mean, I'm not a farmer myself, but I can totally understand the decision-making and what was going on at that point in time. And now we're kind of back at, I don't know, $3.50 a bushel. It's kind of, you know, middle of the road. I mean, people follow farming in Wisconsin. We've got kind of a crisis, you know, ongoing. Dairy industry is not doing very good. We've just got to be rethinking about a transformation of the system somehow to support farming and do it in a way that is beneficial to the environment.
Peter in Hazelhurst has something for us. Hi, Peter.
Hi there. How are you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Well, this time of the year, I fish the Mississippi River, and I cannot understand why we don't have every dam along in the Mississippi River on our border producing electricity. And I'm not talking about giant turbines that you'd have to put in like Grand Coulee, but simple water wheels over the Mississippi at each dam could create, you know, a tremendous amount of electricity, no impact on the environment, 24 hours a day, regardless of the weather. And I think it would be fairly inexpensive.
Remember, one of my faculty, one of my colleagues, Fritz Albert, once did a film on the Wisconsin River. And he called it, I think it was something like Wisconsin's most working river. And it was maybe still is one of the most power generating rivers in the country because of the dams that exist along it. It may be something for another show, but I don't know what kind of work. I know there's been a lot of research done on using waves as power generators in the ocean, which had some potential, and I'm not sure about the dam. Maybe Claudio, you want to
just as a, you know, to follow through on the theme of today, which is thinking about trade-offs. Dams themselves also have big effects upstream and downstream of them, not just for the communities of people who live there, but also for the wildlife that depends on the rivers. There are countries right now that have made huge investments in hydropower. I know one of the places that I've had the opportunity to work for the last 10 years or so is in Iceland, where glaciers are melting. And so now they have to think about other ways that they might be dealing with the shortage of water and dams and the production of energy from their dams there. So, I think there are costs, and there's going to be some uncertainties in the future about water quantity in some parts of the world where that might make it a little harder. I know that wasn't Peter's question was more about it here in Wisconsin. What can we do about that? But, yep.
Deborah was wondering, what kind of research projects are you working on right now?
Oh, we always got something up our sleeve, right? Hopefully... some of what Claudio was speaking about in terms of incorporating the stakeholders, the farmers, people that are affected by the decision-making is kind of a new approach we're taking, trying to integrate the biological, the physical, the social sciences together. We call it the idea of a land lab. I don't know if that's a good word or not, but that's kind of the concept.
UW Land Lab,
yeah. Randy Jackson is a lead on this and a key collaborator of ours. And, yeah, it's this idea of getting people together. And I look at it as sort of a checkpoint of, we don't always have all the answers or understand. How are we going to take the ideas that we come up in our own labs, let's say in terms of decision-making on the landscape, and roll those out, in reality? How are people going to react to that? And the only way that some of that decision-making is going to happen and gain traction is if you involve the farmers from the beginning and the other stakeholders. And we've already had one very informative meeting where we heard some great ideas that we hadn't really been thinking about before. And that's great when science works that way.
Yeah, I mean, and this is, for me, this has certainly been true, where you do research in the field and lab, you're thinking about these very narrow scientific questions, and then when you kind of broaden out and you think about how can the findings from our own basic research help people make better decisions on the ground, there's often a disconnect between the academic research and the really applied practical work that has to help inform policy and land use and things like that. And so one of the things that we've been thinking about in our land lab is really, how do we make the science that we produce within the university more accessible and more usable in these decision-making contexts that that people are looking for, people are dealing with. I mean, we heard it from our callers today. People recognize that there's these trade-offs. What are those trade-offs really going to be? How big are they going to be? How can we change some of our management so as to minimize those? What happens if you do it in this part of the landscape instead of that part of the landscape? These are really practical questions. And we have some of the science. We still need to do some of it. But what we definitely need to do is translate that into terms that can actually be used by the decision makers.
Yeah. And on that note, we are out of time. It's been a great discussion. I want to thank you both. I hope you'll come back and be with us again. Love to have you back.
Yeah, thank you, Larry. Thank you. Anytime.
Well, sorry we're out of time here. Claudio Gratton from the Department of Entomology, professor there. Chris Kocharek, a professor and chair of the Department of Agronomy at the UW-Madison College of Agricultural and Life Sciences. We'll have him back, and we'll talk about this some more. Lots to talk about. There's always a lot to talk about relating to the weather, certainly flooding last summer and again this spring, and we're entering one of the really tough times of the year weather-wise here in Wisconsin and a lot of other places as well. And so we'll talk about that with our weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin, next on the Ideas Network.